We're playing just a little bit of Pavarotti for reasons that will become abundantly clear later. Suffice to say that he's a bridge back to Venice. Now, we've spent quite a lot of time in Venice this week, haven't we? You might recall Jeremy Broughton on the program, Jerry being Professor of Renaissance Studies at Queen Mary Uni, and he was telling us about the incredible links between Elizabethan England and the world of Islam. Political, cultural, diplomatic, all sorts of things. And that took us to Venice because, of course, Shakespeare was only one of a number of Elizabethan playwrights who used Venice as a setting, as you recall from Othello and The Merchant of Venice. On this occasion, we're going back in the 21st century to meet Donna Leon, who was hold in the highest regard. I like her prose, I like her plots, and I like her politics. And she's the author of the Guido Brunetti novels, which have kept me company for decades. Donna, it's great to have you on the program.
It's great to hear Italian sung that beautifully and that clearly. I had forgotten how wonderful he is.
But he was important to our story, wasn't he? Or to your story.
Yeah,
tell us why.
It must be 25 years ago, I was at La Fenice listening to that opera, La Favorita, by Donizetti, with a tenor of lesser talent than Pavarotti. And I was in the dressing room with Gabriele Ferro, the conductor, and his wife, and we started talking about another conductor. And there was an escalation, and we were talking about getting rid of that conductor, finding him dead in the dressing room. And I thought, wow, great idea. I wonder if I could write a murder mystery. The idea had never passed through my mind, and so I thought, yeah, if it began here in the dressing room with the conductor dead, the plot would be launched, and then all I'd have to do would be figure out who killed him and why. I wonder if I could do that. So I started writing a murder mystery, and after about, I don't know, 8 months, 10 months, a year, it was finished. But it was done only because I had had that conversation with Gabriele. If I hadn't had the conversation, I'd still be teaching English literature somewhere, and I wouldn't be sitting in this studio talking to you.
Guido Brunetti, he's a very likable bloke. He's not alone amongst the detectives that come to mind in being sternly moral. Kurt Wallander is. Mm-hmm. But your bloke is so well adjusted. He's almost unique in that regard, isn't he? He's got a happy family life, a terrific wife, charming children, and he's perfectly, utterly sane.
Yeah, I suppose you could say that about him. And he's decent. He's decent and he's kind and he's nice. But I had the sense then, and I think I should bear in mind, and one should bear in mind, that when I wrote the book, I thought it would be a one-off. And so I wanted to spend however much time I had to spend with this character, spending it with someone that I would like, someone that I would find simpatico. And so I gave him the qualities, thinking it would be for a book, that I would like to see in a person. So he's intelligent, he's well-read, he's decent, he's kind to his children, he loves his wife, he loves life, and he reads a lot.
And let it be said that you are not a Venetian, although many people would make that assumption. Heavens above, you're actually from New Jersey.
I am, and my family is my grandparents are Irish, Spanish, and German. So there's no Italian in me whatsoever, by blood. But I suppose there is some now by osmosis.
Tell me how you got to Venice.
I went there first in 68, I think, 68 or 69, and I had the good fortune to make the acquaintance and then the friendship of two Venetians, a married couple of jewelers, Roberta and Franco, who remain my best friends there to this date. And it was easier then to make friends with Venetians. And so each year after 69, I would go back to Venice for a week, 2 weeks, and stay with them. And I was assimilated into their families, his family and her family, on either side of the marriage. And as years passed, I would always go back to Venice once or twice a year because I didn't have a permanent job, I didn't have steady work, and I had a lot of free time, which I chose always to spend in Venice. And then in 81, when I decided that it was time to stop being an academic mercenary and living in different odd places, I decided to go and settle in Venice and stayed with them for a couple of weeks until Franco, either out of friendship or desperation, found me a place to live. And I settled there and quickly found a job teaching English literature, which is what I had been doing. And then I stayed and stayed.
Is there a hint of you in The Good Detective's charming wife? Because she also doesn't want to be an academic mercenary, and she also likes teaching English.
Yeah, she does, and she's also a hothead. At times, when confronted with terrible things, my immediate response is Paola's kind of hot-headed, violent response. But after some time, and the time grows shorter as I grow older, my more reasoned and civilized Brunetti-like character asserts itself, and I can view matters with calm and clarity, or more calm and clarity. So there are parts of both of them in me.
I, like you, have been going to Venice forever. I tend to go off-season when it's bitterly cold, but at least it's fairly empty. You are now being driven out of the place, aren't you? Not only by the rising waters, but by the rising tide of tourism.
Well, to say that I'm driven is melodramatic. I have chosen to spend less time there during the times when the city is crowded, and that's now from April until October, the beginning of November. And so for those months, I go down once or twice a month for a couple of days just to see friends and remain in contact with the city. But I prefer not to be there when there is the massive jamming of tourists, and when to go out of my house is to be angry at what I can control, and so it's easier not to be there.
And of course Guido is angry as well. He's finding the place as oppressive as you for exactly the same reasons.
Yeah, I think that any Venetian is exasperated by this uncontrolled, insane tourism. It's a city of 56,000 residents, which now has perhaps more than 30 million, but at least 30 million tourists a year. At least that's the number I've read. I don't know how they count that number, but the estimate is 30 million. And the city becomes, for the time of the tourist when the wildebeests are migrating through Venice, it's impossible to live there.
No wonder the city is slowly sinking under that weight. Now, one of the things I've observed in your writing, in the books over the last 25 of them, is they have, in fact, got more political. Would you accept that? Because you get very angry about what goes on in that city that both of us love.
Yeah, the books have become more political, but they're not directed specifically at Venetian politics or Italian politics, but in a sense at world politics, because some of the problems that the books have discussed, the traffic in women, the traffic in atomic waste, these are world problems, not specifically European nor Italian problems. And I think as one gets older, if one is lucky, one becomes more reflective. And then one becomes more concerned with big things rather than the double parker in front of my house or the loud music coming from the bar downstairs. Those things become less important to one professionally. And to me professionally, if I'm going to engage in something political, I'd like it to be something that people in Australia and that people in Canada could identify with, because they have a similar problem.
Well, that certainly works, Donna. I have to tell you that again and again one makes these connections as one listens. There's a class difference between Brunetti and his wife, who's from a very aristocratic background. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you write about class almost as much as John le Carré writes about class.
Yeah. Well, it's a living factor in Venice. I have been, because of the friendship I have with a man who is connected to the aristocracy in many ways, I have begun to move in that world. And I'm very conscious of it's almost a Philip Pullman kind of cutting through the invisible veil between you and another reality. I'm very conscious of passing through that invisible veil to another way of looking at the world. I find their way worthy of respect, because these are people who have been in this city for, in some cases, more than 1,000 years. And so their concern for the city is far different from my own, because it's based on 1,000 years of upholding one's name. And I thought, as an old lefty, that I would have the usual kind of allergy to aristocracy, and quite the opposite. I have come in most cases to respect the way that they love the city and the reason for which they love the city.
One of the things which I hadn't comprehended, and this is in a sense a subtle form of self-censorship, is that although the books are translated into an inordinate number of languages, they're not available in Italian. Tell us why.
Well, it really can't be called self-censorship, but it's self-protection. I would prefer to live in a place where I'm invisible, where no one is aware that I have been successful at whatever it is that I do, because the life that is offered, or that can be offered to people who are successful or famous, to use that word, is not a particularly appealing one, because people know who you are and they stop you on the street to say things and they treat you differently. And to the degree that I can avoid that among my friends, not my friends in Venice because they know that I'm a writer, but among the people in Venice who know that I'm a writer and that's all they know, I would prefer not to be famous and not to be known as being famous.
Both Paolo and you are readers of Henry James, so you'd be aware of the way he always wrote about that slight distance between Europeans and Americans, Portrait of a Lady, the Europeans. Is that true for you? And if so, how does it manifest itself?
I have one example that I've used before. A couple of years ago, I was speaking to a woman that I was standing next to at a bar, and she started talking about living across from a hospital. And she was talking, she lived on the other side of a canal. She had a third floor apartment with a terrace. And she said that she would see the infermieri, the nurses, male and female, go out on the balcony on the second floor. And she said, and they would. And I understood her to mean what they would do. And I said, Signora, are you suggesting that they go out on the terrace at lunchtime and they engage? And she said, si. And I said, Signora, why are you so outraged by their behavior? Here am I, the American, thinking, oh, so I said, is it an offense to public decency? And she said, no, they should be working. And I thought, this is it, that I, as the American, think that the idea of people engaging in some sort of a sexual activity in public is an offense to public decency, whereas she thinks quite the contrary. Who cares what they do, but they should be in the hospital working at that time. And that's why I will never be Italian. I might be European, but I'll never be Italian.
History records that you don't have or didn't have a TV set. Is that still
no,
the case?
No, I don't. No. I'd rather live with a pit viper.
Well, in that case, you probably haven't had to watch Midsummer Murders, which is set in a little part of little village in England, where the death toll from murders is now greater than anywhere else on earth. I think the entire community has all been killed two or three times, whereas the fact is that murder is comparatively rare in Venice. But if we find a body bobbing in the canal, I did it. Yeah, but you do it for a purpose, not simply to propel a plot, but to lead us into an area where we're looking at corruption, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because who did it is really, I've always found it a pretty boring question, and the answer is sometimes boring as well. Because even when we hear of a murder, we want to know why they did it, not who did it. Because in most murders, it's pretty easy to figure out who did it. It's the wife, the husband, the lover. But why they did it is interesting. And that's what the books try to examine. What would drive these people to murder? In some cases, it's a very short step, but in some, it's a very long trudge before they actually go around killing someone.
Well, that takes us back, of course, to Othello, doesn't it? It's why he killed Desdemona that matters, not the fact that he does it. Now, one of the things I love about the book is the layering of characters. We've talked about Brunetti and the wife and the kids, but he has a boss, the most pompous, pretentious boss, Pater, who hovers on the border of corruption. It's never quite clear how he operates, except that he's a slippery and obsequious to anyone higher up. In other words, he kisses up and bullies down. Mm-hmm. Would locals recognize him as a type?
I think anyone who has ever worked in an office would recognize him, because Pater is... There are millions of Paters. I worked for Pater for most of my life. I worked for Pata in many, many countries, and it was always the same. The person who was a lickspittle to those above him, and as you said, a bully to those below him. And so I think Pata is someone who resonates among many readers because he is such a common, he's a common figure.
What usually happens when you've got a franchise like this is there are spin-offs, and if there's one that's aching to happen, it involves Signorina Elettra, helps Brunetti navigate computers and keeps him entertained, and, and perhaps there's a hint of flirtation. A completely fictitious character, or do you know a Signorina Elettra?
Well, the story that's told in one of the very early books is that Signorina Elettra is there because when sanctions were being imposed upon South Africa, her boss at the bank asked her to take dictation of a letter to South Africa, and she refused, saying that the UN had imposed sanctions on South Africa. And she quit her job as a result of that and came to work at the Questura. I stole the story from a friend whose sister did just that. She refused to take dictation of a letter from her boss, who I believe was the director of the Banca d'Italia branch in Venice. And I was so impressed by her courage and her coherence in remaining honest about sanctions that I thought I'd use that in a book. So as an explanation to Signorina Elettra's very, very perplexing presence in the Questura, I use that as her reason for having gone there to work.
Talking to you off air, I insisted that Australia has to be the centre of the Brunetti fan club, but that's not the case. It turns out to be Austria. For heaven's sake, why?
I don't know. Well, the Austrians were the bosses in Venice some centuries ago. And the Austrians have always had a soft place in their hearts and their heads for Venice, as have the Germans. And so I think that the Austrians, who perhaps are the most statistically frequent visitors to the city because they can drive there from Vienna, depending on how fast they drive, in 5 hours, 4 hours, they have this kinship with Venice. And so they've latched onto Brunetti.
You've sold something like 100 million books by now. You must be gobsmacked, constantly astonished.
I think that number is wildly exaggerated. And that's not modesty speaking, but that's the little that I know about the numbers. That is wildly exaggerated.
We've talked about corruption.
I would that it were true. As the Italians say, magari, I wish.
Okay. We've talked about class in Venice. We haven't talked about race. We haven't talked about religion. And as I was mentioning in the intro, we spent a lot of time this week looking at the long history of interactions between Christians and Muslims in Venice. What's the demography of Venice these days in terms of faith?
Well, Christianity is dying in Europe, or Catholicism is dying in Europe. I don't know about Christianity, but certainly Catholicism is. The numbers are down every year. People are more distressed with the church's refusal. If one were a politer person than I would say reluctance, but the church's refusal to change, continuing refusal to change. And so they just stop going. They're not interested in the party anymore, so they don't go. There is no, as far as I can see, there is no Islamic presence in the city. There's a Valdensian church. There are two synagogues at least, but there is no evidence of Islamic religious practice in the city.
But there are quite a lot of Africans, of course, peddling in the streets.
Mm-hmm. Yes, most of them are from Senegal. They are known as vous comprez. We're supposed to call them venditori ambulanti, walking vendors, but they're still called vous comprez because that's their name. And they are very, very well received in Venice because they've been there a long time. They have wit, they have grace, they have great beauty as well, and Italians are always suckers for beauty. And they're funny. They're part of the community. There is, however, as I mentioned in this book, there's a new kind of African who is now visible in the city. They are different physiologically. They're shorter. They're thicker. And They are different in their approach to people. They'll stop you. They don't stop you in the street. They'll stand almost in your path and hold up a finger, hold up a hand with a finger and say, excuse me, and try to stop you. And it doesn't work with Italians. The Vukumpra have learned how to present themselves to non-Africans, to Italians and to Europeans. And I assume that within a year, these new Africans will be clever enough, because they are clever, they'll be clever enough to change the way that they approach people, and they will become more successful as a result. They'll just do some rebranding and continue in business.
Donna, I will be plunging into the darkness after this program and driving 3 or 4 hours until I get back to the farm. And as is commonly the case, you will be my companion along with your splendid detective. Congratulations on a remarkable and surprising career and on the 25th Brunetti novel, The Waters of Eternal Youth, which in a sense takes us back pretty much to the beginning in its subject and setting. Published by Penguin Random House. Coming up now, another extraordinary woman, my old friend Barbara Blackman.